half. We have Glenn Bukowski and Rochelle Van Deventer, who will be working on issues related to contracts and engineering questions, getting work started, whatever you might have. We have Lance and myself are going to be talking about the government programs and the issues of getting started, driver's license questions, any type of government questions. We have Rob and Greg Brooks, who will talk about safety protocols, missed dig issues that you might have, and then also with us today as our guests and partners, Eric Flesland, to support any contractual questions that might come up. And then Aaron Graves, who will help support labor law questions, getting folks back to work. Aaron did a wonderful webinar for us here a week ago where we had nearly 200 participants. A lot of good questions there were answered, but many of them have come up again today. And Aaron is here to and happy to answer them. And then finally, Mike Buck, our partner in healthcare, to answer any questions that you might have about healthcare, continuing payments, those types of things, what Blue Cross and Blue Shield is doing, other carriers, et cetera. And then Miriam will help guide this. Sarah and Danielle are with us as well to help us with any technical issues, because this is the first webinar that MITA is ever doing. So we have a full slate of our team available to help out. Obviously, we've been very busy at MITA. We've put out literally on average about two bulletins per day, every other day or so, since the beginning of this about 6 weeks ago. And so a lot of information flow has happened. Probably the latest news that you should all be aware of is word came out late last night, about 8:30, that the governor is expected to Friday issue an executive order to allow all construction to go back to work. That includes residential, commercial, local projects that have been sidelined during this COVID stay-at-home order. And the word is that all construction will go back to work. Now, what does that mean? There'll be, I'm sure, some rules that are put into place, some controls, et cetera. But we as MITA have presented safety protocols that were developed between our team to make sure that projects are handled safely and with the health and well-being of the employees being first and forefront. So beyond that, I won't get into much detail until we start our questions, because that's what this is for. And so I'll turn it over to Miriam to explain how you ask a question if you haven't already. But we do have several that are already lined up in the queue that were emailed to Miriam ahead of time.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us. There are three ways for you to participate today on this interactive webinar. There is a raise your hand feature. I'm sure you've noticed next to your names, there's a little hand. If you click on it, that tells us as panelists and hosts that you would like to ask a question. So we can allow you to ask your question out loud if that is the way you'd want to do it. There is also a chat box feature, probably located in the lower right side of your screens, where you can submit a question that way. And we're also monitoring the chat box. There's also a Q&A feature, which is at the bottom of your screen. And it says Q&A, and it's got two little, looks like word bubbles. And you can use that as well to submit a question, and we will try to get an answer for you as quickly as possible. When we call on you to speak, if you do raise your hand, because that's how you want to talk, I will unmute you so that you can do that. So we just ask, because there are so many of you on the call, that you identify yourself with your name and your company, and then you can ask your question. We are recording the webinar so that if anyone wants it after we are done today, or if you hopped on and had to hop off early, we are happy to share that once the webinar has concluded and we get the link for you. And we encourage you to ask your questions as you think of them. This is kind of a sort of a free-flowing conversation. We're going to try to keep it somewhat organized by topic, utilities, safety, engineering, things like that. But if you have a question and you think of it, go ahead and use one of those three features to ask your question so that we can answer it as that conversation is happening, not 20 minutes later. Mike already introduced all of our panelists, so don't hesitate to take advantage of that. But I did want to read a very quick disclaimer about the legal and healthcare information. This information that's being shared is for informational purposes only. So the information that we are sharing here today is not intended to create, and the receipt of it does not evidence an attorney-client relationship. So anyone listening to the information that we provide today should seek professional counsel. So if you have your own legal team or your own healthcare people, you should certainly be talking to them about those needs, but we are happy to answer questions and provide information today. Last couple of items. If you don't feel like asking your question live today during the webinar, that's no problem. Feel free to email me directly. I'll have Sarah put my email in the chat box so you can see it. And you can certainly email me your question, and I would be happy to triage it to the appropriate panelists so that we can get you an answer in writing as soon as possible, if that's what you would prefer. So I think that's it. So we can get started. We got several questions in advance of the webinar. One of the first ones was about employees and layoffs and unemployment. And the question was, what can I do about an employee who has been on layoff because our business is low, and now that things are opening up, he is afraid to come back to work? I also know he is making more on unemployment than he was being paid by me.
So, Aaron, this would be a question for you. This was the major topic of your webinar for MITA last week. So go ahead and jump into this one.
Thanks, Mike. And it's a great question. It's a common question that employers all over are having. Essentially, if the employee is just saying that I'm afraid to come to work, it's a situation where you'd want to look at your labor contract and also your policies to see whether or not you could actually take disciplinary action against that employee if they don't want to come in. I will tell you that that employee will likely receive unemployment from the state. However, you can notify that employee that just being afraid doesn't qualify you. And we're going to deny that. And eventually the state is going to come back and look at these issues and may make you pay back the money with interest. The other thing that you'd want to look out for is there are qualifiers under the new unemployment, it's Executive Order 57. You know, for example, if they've got a COVID condition, if they're at risk, then they would qualify for unemployment. You may want to say, hey, if you have one of these conditions, we'll provide you with a leave, or we'll provide you with continued insurance, but you need to provide me with documentation. The employee says, I'm not going to provide you with documentation, or I don't have any documentation. You write down that employee didn't provide you with any documentation, because that's going to help you win that unemployment case. You really have to use a carrot and a stick to try to get that employee to return to work. The carrot is, look, we're going to have long-term job security. I'm going to pay you. The stick is, you may not actually be entitled to this unemployment.
I think some employers are also offering up the carrot of an incentive in terms of a signing bonus, not paid now, come back to work and stay with us for a minimum of 3 months, something like that. And we will have a X number of bonus for you. And they're offering that to employees to entice them to come off of the government assistance programs. So, you know, something I've heard the range of $1,000, one of the paychecks on top of their normal paychecks, all the way up to $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 at the end of the season. So that is certainly a way that employers are trying to incentivize their employees to come back to work and get off the assistance programs right now.
Okay. The next question was sort of a series of questions. The first one being, this individual was looking for state or federal rules contractors are required to provide to their employees. The CDC has general guidelines, but no ruling as to what the employer must comply to.
So I think Rob and Greg, this one would be for you guys. Why don't you go ahead and jump into it, Rob?
Yeah, I would just refer back to one of our earlier bulletins that we did with the ACEC, Asphalt Pavement Association, Michigan Concrete, Michigan Aggregate Association, and the Road Preservation Association. It's a two-page document, so we tried to provide guidance on that in various areas as far as communication, HIPAA, screening, PPE, and various types of things. So we've been recommending this two-page document as a policy of sorts, just as a guideline for people to go through, and then we've been answering questions that come from that on a regular basis. So, Greg, would you like to add?
Well, we talked yesterday, we sent that bulletin yesterday that had a little bit of clarification on there also. I think that covered most of the questions that I've received along those lines, that yes, the employer is required to provide PPE to the employee, but it is only recommended that the employee wears the PPE.
Yeah. I think that follows the bulletin that we sent out yesterday. And Miriam, I think we had another question about this, a little different context, but the question was, do I, as the employer, have to provide the PPE? And to the contractual question for Glenn, Rochelle, and Eric, can I get reimbursed for that now that I'm required to supply it on the job after I sign my contract? So, First of all, Rob and Greg, the employer is required, as Greg just said, to provide all PPE, face masks, whatever it might be, rubber gloves, that type of stuff, even though they had already signed the contract, then is the question for Glenn, Eric, Rochelle. Go ahead, Rob.
So, and just to clarify it even further, the MyOSHA regs are very clear. There's a general duty clause that says essentially the employer is to provide a workplace free from recognizable hazards and then provide anything required to meet those hazards. So the MyOSHA regs are very clear on this issue as far as the employer having to provide it. Now, if there's wiggle rooms in a contract for getting paid for it, I would defer to Glenn or Rochelle.
Well, Rob, I think we put up a couple different bulletins on this. I'm sorry.
Workers may not be prepared for, but it from a MyOSHA standpoint, that's how the laws are written.
Okay, I think from a MDOT contractual standpoint, I think MDOT's made it clear to date in all their guidance documents that the delays are non-compensable, excusable. The issue of whether you have to provide masks now to your employees when you didn't bid the job that way, I don't know. We haven't had a direct conversation about that, but I'm expecting, as Rob said, it's an employer-employee thing, and I don't think there's anything coming out of them that's saying, yeah, we're going to pay for additional PPE related to COVID-19. It's an employer-employee issue. I guess if you think you are owed additional compensation for a box of masks, you could always try to claim that and get reimbursed from that, but there's been no direction from MDOT that they're going to be paying for that.
Glenn, we have a whole bunch of people on here that don't care about MDOT. We got to talk broader than that. So I think that probably that your position is probably correct, Eric. Your thoughts on just any type of contract getting reimbursed for PPE?
Well, there's the legal and then there's the practical answer. The legal answer is if the government has imposed another layer of cost on your contract that you obviously didn't consider, wasn't in your bid, then you should be entitled to compensation. The practical is, do you really want to go and penny pinch your projects asking your owner for the cost of a box of masts? I don't mean to belittle it, but you also have to remember your relationship with the owner. They're flying blind as well. And for that marginal cost, it may not be worth destroying your relationship, or at least setting, going back to work. That's the tone you set right from the get-go. But legally speaking, you probably have a legitimate claim for the additional cost. It'd be like a new guard on a piece of equipment that's been mandated that wasn't there before. But again, there's the practical consideration.
Yeah. Shell, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I have had this conversation with somebody before, and I don't think there's anything that's clear cut that's going to be like, yep, they're going to pay for it. It's easy, just submit it. But if you filed a claim, you may win it. So,
Greg, you kind of touched on it before. We have a follow-up question on the chat box that asks, can an employer make it mandatory to wear PPE, mainly face masks in the office and or the work site? You touched on it, Greg, and then Rob, if you have anything to add to what Greg says.
I believe, yes, they can. It's my understanding that they can.
Make it mandatory down to their employees. Yep. Rob? Rob, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, so you can make any. I do. You can make anything as an employer mandatory that you want from a safety policy. The MyOSHA regs are a minimum. So anything you want to do to go over and above it as an employer is okay. The face mask area is a trick bag, though. The MyOSHA regs are pretty clear. If you, as an employer, tell somebody that they should wear a face mask, that becomes a mandatory program. And if you look at the MyOSHA regs on respiratory, requires medical monitoring. That requires a whole lot of stuff. So most of our members over the years, even with the new silica standard, will opt for what we call a voluntary mandatory program. So if you say that it's voluntary, you get out of the arena of the medical monitoring, and then you strongly suggest that, especially in areas where you're going to be 6 foot or more closer, that we're providing these masks for a reason, and that you should wear them. But if you get into a very strong mandatory situation from a MyOSHA standpoint, you could open up Pandora's box as far as having an advanced policy and other things. Our members that use a mandatory program do things like lead paint, blasting for lead on bridges and other things. So, but
okay. I do have a question here in the Q&A box. We received an update from MITA explaining the availability of COVID-19 testing for essential workers. However, after following the procedure for getting a code to have our workers tested, I was informed by the district manager of our testing center that the testing is only for frontline workers at this point. He further described frontline workers as those who work directly with the general public, such as food supply workers and assisted living staff. I was told that it will be opened further and should expect a call from him to that regard. Do you know when this will start happening?
Lance, you want to take that one?
Sure. So it should be happening now is my answer to that direct question. We have been monitoring this, and when we first gave the indication that testing was available, we immediately got some members calling saying that it wasn't available for individuals who didn't show symptoms. And so we followed up with our contacts through the critical infrastructure programs, and they admitted that it was slow implementing to all the sites, but that the word was getting around that anyone who is working outside of the household is eligible for a test. And there's a variety of testing sites that are out there for that. I think finally, there is a, in our last bulletin about this that we did this week, there is a directive from the Department of Health and Human Services that says just that. And we encourage members to have their employee call ahead, as this individual has, and make sure that the location is testing. And then if they are, have the employee have the essential worker notice that an employer should have given to their employees with them, as well as this directive from the Department of Health and Human Services that individuals who don't show symptoms but are still required to work outside of their home are allowed to be tested.
This has been a very confusing process. The administration told us that they were opening up testing to any essential workers who is required to work outside the household a week ago yesterday. We put that information out to the industry, and we immediately started getting folks calling us and telling us that there was confusion out there. The problem was the administration was not getting it to the testing sites in an efficient manner. And then you have folks like this administrator at this testing facility saying it is only frontline employees. Frontline employees are no different than an essential employee. Essential employees, we understand the medical folks needed to get tested first, but now they believe there's enough testing facilities and tests out there that it's all essential employees can get tested now. The word just isn't getting down to these employees at these testing sites. So Lance is exactly correct. We recommend you make the call, set an appointment, and then send the employee with the two key pieces of information: their essential employee letter from you, the employer, and the notice from the DHHS that we sent out yesterday.
And we will continue to push the administration on making sure that they get the information down to the individual healthcare facilities. But you know, quite honestly, that directive or that memo that we had in our bulletin yesterday should be enough. It's an official directive from the Department of Health and Human Services that it specifically states that anyone working outside of the home is eligible for a test, regardless if they show symptoms or not.
Okay.
Mike, just offer Mike Buck any comments from you, Mike Buck, on testing, what you're hearing from the circles that you work in, Blue Cross, et cetera?
No, thanks, Mike. And obviously, Salas wishes everybody good health here this morning. Specific to your question, I think for those essential workers, Lance nailed the process. For those non-essential workers, to support social distancing, telephonic access to your primary care physician should be your starting point.
All right, Miriam.
Okay. Going back here to the questions we got ahead of time. Another question that we've gotten was, will the townships or county rules for temperature checking and questionnaires supersede any of the state or federal rules?
So I'll jump in on this one, and then Lance, if you have anything to add. So we did ask the administration a couple times now how the preemption rules work, and local agencies can have stricter policies and rules than the state that is allowed. Just like with Rob, my OSHA can be stricter than federal OSHA. It kind of trickles down. The states can be stricter than the feds, the locals can be stricter than the state. And so, yes, local agencies, counties, county health departments can have guidelines that are stricter than what the executive orders have put down. However, we are seeing that there is quite a bit of flexibility at the county level with regards to enforcement on construction sites. The focus of these temperature taking orders at the county level is folks working in offices side by side, not necessarily construction sites. We have reached out to various counties like Oakland County, like Ingham County, and they have said we are not looking at construction as one of our main areas of focus. So we probably are not going to see a whole lot of enforcement of health, county health associates coming out onto construction projects. However, I'll go back to Greg and Rob then say, you know, the protocols that have been put into place are pretty important here. That you have to have the safe job site, you have to have the hand washing, you have to have the face masks available if you're working within 6 feet of one another, et cetera, et cetera. But a point of entry where you got to put a gate up around your project and test everyone to come in is impossible for our industry. And I think most folks recognize that and understand it. But I would say that talking about the individual who has come in contact with someone with COVID, had a family member, or has shown symptoms themselves, there has to be a specific protocol in place for these types of individuals that you have to recognize. And that is if they have encountered an individual, say their wife works at a medical facility, we have had this question, has come in contact with COVID patients. That employee working in the construction industry should take self-temperatures at home every day before coming into work. And if they exceed 100 degrees, then they probably should go get tested. Or you can require that those employees go get tested. However, that's going to be an ongoing thing for an employee that I gave in that example. So I would say that temperature testing, self-testing at home before an individual like that comes into work is probably the best practice. Some contractors are doing temperature testing on job sites, but the other thing is to have conversations, pre-job conversations. Is everyone feeling well? Has anyone had any symptoms? Has anyone come in contact with anyone? Those are the types of things that we have put out in our protocol, and I'll throw it to Rob and Greg to fill in any blanks that I left open.
Yeah, I think that if you're going to go, first of all, I'd like to reiterate, there's a lot of documentation that temperature testing is not required. So if you decide to go down that road, you're taking on all the responsibilities that go with it. You know, the HIPAA laws still exist wherever you're at. And so that information, it must be kept confidential. But then all of a sudden, you know, people aren't stupid. You've got a guy on a job that tests higher than 100. And what are you going to do? You're not going to keep him. You're going to send him home and everyone can do math. So you've created kind of an issue there for your crews on the job site. And then the other caveat with that is if you're testing over 100, you've obviously had it for more than a few days before that test. So it's a good way to strike fear into a whole crew and lose numerous crews over testing at the job site. So we're trying to, I like Mike's advice, you got to put the horse before the cart and try to encourage people to do some medical monitoring on their home, at home, that's private and confidential. And then if they don't feel like they should be coming into work, they're simply going to have a mechanism to relay that to their supervision.
Greg, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just, you know, one of the best scenarios that I've seen is the employer is providing the employee with the material to take their own temperatures and recommending that they take their own temperatures before they come to work.
And that is if you've run into a situation where you believe you might have the symptoms, but you can also have them do it just because you want to be completely safe, but it's primarily because you've run into a situation, right, Greg?
Correct.
Yeah. All right, Miriam.
So same individuals had one last question. Who pays for all the additional costs related to new safety rules?
We covered this one.
The SBA and the PPP?
Yep.
Oh, okay. There was another question about employees staying at home. I think we covered that. I have another question about masks, and I know we already talked about it, but the question is, are masks required on construction sites, even if one is outdoors and at a distance of more than 6 feet away from other individuals at all times?
Greg, you want to cover this? You put it out in the bulletin yesterday.
Yeah. Again, it's like I said earlier, it's the requirement is that the employer provide masks to the employee. Other than that, there's no requirements. It's highly recommended if they're working within 6 feet of each other to be wearing them.
Okay.
What type of mask, Greg?
The N95 is obviously the suggested one. If it's not available, any cloth mask, homemade mask, bandana. I've seen a lot of creative ideas out there.
Rob, you have anything to add to that?
I did, and I lost my train of thought. I would just caution that there are job-specific tasks that already required masks. So, you know, to keep that in mind as far as going forward, there's two enforcement areas here. We've been told that, you know, there isn't going to be a mask police out there for this COVID thing, but MyOSHA still exists, and there are certain job functions that are related to silica and other practices that do require a mask that, you know, so don't be thinking that, oh, I can just work without masks or I don't need them in certain applications because those rules and regulations didn't go away.
Excellent point.
Okay. Sort of along similar lines here, a couple of questions from Angie at J Rank Electric. They have an employee who was tested this week for COVID antibodies. His doctor suspects he had COVID back in January. If the antibody test comes back positive, are we required to notify staff since the potential exposure to them was 3 to 4 months ago?
Aaron, you want to answer this one?
Yeah, I can address this. It's a good question. I had this come up from a couple of different clients that are actually doing antibody testing. And my question back to them was why are we doing antibody testing? It's just testing that somebody had something in the past. There's no proven test there's no evidence to say that means the person can't get it again in the future, or that means that they're immune from getting it. So that's information that I would say, as an employer, you don't want to know whether or not somebody, what their antibodies are. It's like knowing whether or not they had hepatitis in the past. It's not related to work. I don't see any relation to it, to work. So I don't think it provides you with any information that helps you avoid the risk or is related to your safety in the workplace. So I would not request that information, and it's really none of your business as an employer.
Mike, do you want to talk about, just for a second, the information that you have about antibody tests right now, just so that people understand? They see antibody tests on the news and all the progress that's being made, but there are questions about it, correct?
Yeah, there's still a lot of questions, and I think Aaron really answered it perfectly that, so what? You get the test, what are you going to do with it? It's in the rearview mirror. There's a lot of discussion on the accuracy of it. There's a lot of discussion on who's paying for that. Again, if it's not coming through your primary care physician and you're doing it online, or you're doing it with some of the unapproved sites, you can get a mixed result. So I'm not real sure of the value other than having the opportunity to understand that you may or may not have had the corona positive results.
But there's a lot of them out there, as I understand it. And again, this is just trying to read through this because I think there's a lot of hope for the antibody test, but there's also a lot of question marks because people are getting false positives because it's it's giving a wider swath of coronavirus results than just COVID-19. And so there's a lot of work to be done. So I guess the point from all three of us is don't put a ton of stock in just antibody tests right now. Let's let the science progress.
Right. We can circulate the most recent University of San Francisco results, Berkeley. There's a lot of different testing, but there's only two credible testing the industry is really reflecting on. And we can put a MITA bulletin out on some of those results.
Great.
Okay. Similar question that was posed to us in the Q&A. We have an employee that called in saying that he has a cold. Should we require him to get tested and stay home until he gets the results?
So I guess I'll jump into that one first. Cold symptoms are certainly a symptom that you have to be aware of. I guess I would go back to what we talked about where you can ask the employee to go to their physician and just get tested. It's a simple test. Mike, the insurance companies are covering it for the most part, correct?
Yeah, it's as everybody knows by now, it's been expanded. There is zero cost sharing for the testing. They've even waived deductibles and co-pays for admissions by certain carriers insured. Self-funded clients have options relative to admissions, but testing, 100% covered.
So to the question, your employee has two options. Either they take the 14-day quarantine, self-quarantine for 14 days, and have to go on the government assistance programs, or they go right away and get tested. It's a pretty simple matter. Those are the two options.
Okay.
Go ahead, Miriam.
Go
ahead, Rob.
I had a, maybe this is an errand, but what I read into that question was, it sounded like the employer was, they're asking about the employer requiring certain things. And I feel like there's like a little nuance there that Aaron might want to address.
Well, and I think he can, but I think I laid him out that the employer can require a 14-day quarantine or go get tested. I mean, like you said, employers can require certain things, but Aaron, go ahead and fill in any blanks that I might've left.
I agree with what everyone has said. You could require the 14-day quarantine. You can require the employee to go get tested. Right now, the EEOC has really eased up on the requirements for medical testing because of COVID. So if the person's got any of the symptoms, you can send them for testing. What I would caution, though, is that if you're giving the employee the 14 days out of work and then go collect $962 a week on unemployment, that may not work out well for your business. Right. So you may want to say you need to go get tested, and I want your either a clean bill of health or that you've been exposed or that you've got a symptom with medical documentation before I put you out of work. Otherwise, you may have everyone who's got cold symptoms.
Yeah.
Okay. Is an office and a warehouse considered an enclosed public space per Executive Order 59. Some of our warehouse employees do not want to wear face coverings. We covered this part. Can we provide them but allow them to not wear them if they wish? I don't see anything in the order about employers requiring employees to wear them, only that they have to provide them, which I know, Greg, you covered more than once now, but it seems to me that is a tricky question because an office or a warehouse is an enclosed space. So,
I guess that just kind of falls right in the lines with what we've said before. Yes, it is considered an enclosed space or the verbiage there, but yes, the employer can require it, but there isn't anything in the executive order that requires them to wear the mask.
Okay.
That responsibility falls on the employer.
Okay.
Yep.
We have an employee who says he was instructed by his mom's doctor to self-quarantine because he lives with her and she has COPD. I've asked him to self-certify, but he wants to take the time off unpaid. I want him to certify so we can pay him via the EPSLA, and I am pushing him hard on this. Can I classify his leave as such without him self-certifying or even with him fighting me to take it as paid leave?
Aaron, you want to handle that one?
Yep, great question. You can require that he provide you with the documentation in order to receive the paid leave. If he doesn't provide you with the documentation, I would not provide him with the paid leave, because then you may have an issue when you go to do your taxes, because you need that information to certify that you paid the leave and that it's actually a tax, you get a tax credit for it. I think that answers the question.
Okay. Another question. Most of our employees came back to work in early March and performed their return to work drug tests and went to work. After 1 to 2 weeks, we were shut down via the COVID-19 pandemic and have been off for more than 30 days, but are going back to work next week. Is there any exemption to the employers and employees that would not make it mandatory to perform another return to work test and absorb this cost again? Specifically, because this shutdown was not of our doing. This is a significant cost when you figure over 120 employees times the cost of the test, plus the payroll hours paid to the employee to visit, wait, perform the test, and return to work.
That's a long one. Mm-hmm. Is it in the Q&A, or was it sent to us?
It was sent ahead of time.
Okay. I mean, it touches on government programs. I guess it's such a long question. I'm struggling with the. Let me see here. Let's go on to another question, Miriam, and then maybe we can circle back to it.
Okay. All right, this is probably for Rob. As a natural gas contractor, we are regulated by Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration and are required to follow through on certain DOT drug testing requirements. A negative test is required before performing any DOT safety sensitive tasks. We are also, that's the background to the question I just asked.
In regards to this question too, Doug had asked me this a while back, and I've got some feelers out on the DOT, and maybe it's something I forwarded to the Lance too, so I know he's looking into it on behalf of Doug. But I think that he's got two paragraphs here that are very complex, and I don't know. I'm not comfortable with giving the guidance on it until I get some guidance, so.
Okay, so maybe we can address that one post-webinar for him.
We're trying.
Yeah.
I was hoping to have it pre-webinar for him.
Okay. We got another question in the Q&A. What if an employee is invited back to work at the office? Employee is working remotely now, but the employee now has said that she will not return to the office due to lack of childcare and virtual schooling. What is the employer's position?
Aaron, this is a question for you.
Yes. Number one, if you're a FFCRA employer, meaning you have fewer than 500 employees, then this employee may be eligible for the EPL or EFMLA, the emergency FMLA. The first 2 weeks are unpaid. The next 10 weeks are paid. The employee was able to work remotely. But once you say come back to the office, if the employee can provide documentation to say, number one, the school is closed, which they can all do, right? I mean, that's easy to get. And then number two, that their normal care provider is unavailable, then the person's going to be out 10 weeks and you're going to be paying them 2/3 of their normal pay, up to $200 per day for that leave. It may be a smarter alternative to let them continue to work remotely.
That question, let me just follow that question up. That question is kind of a added level of concern for folks, because there are parents who don't have to care just for a child, but this schooling at home has added an extra layer of responsibility to the parents that really has never been there for folks that aren't used to homeschooling. And this homeschooling thing has really become quite a burden for a lot of folks. And so I think, Aaron, just a little more follow-up on that. I know that the federal rules that came down said that child care is an acceptable means to receiving the government assistance, but this really does add to it for sure. And I know you touched on it, but I just wanted to elaborate on that part of it, because it's an extra layer that I don't think people thought about right up front.
Right. And you hit a key part. Number one, the employee needs to be a parent of the child. And number two, they have to be able to provide, they have to establish, number one, that the school is closed, like I said, easy enough. And then number two, that there's no other alternative for the child care. And that means that there isn't another parent at home. Maybe a grandparent took care of the child at one time. You're never going to get documentation from a doctor or some other source, but then the person could just self-certify to you, look, grandma's no longer able to take care of the child because grandma's an at-risk for COVID. So she's got an immunodeficiency issue, or she's got a COPD. So she can't take care of the child like she used to, or can't do the child care stuff, or the schooling. So I've got a, employee, parent, that have to watch the child. Again, in that situation, if remote work is available, that gets you out of the trouble. Otherwise, you may be providing that person with 10 weeks of paid leave. It's coming out, you get a tax credit for it, but it's coming out of your pocket.
We have another question in the chat feature. What are the minimum requirements that an employer must meet for an office and warehouse environment? Further, what can an employer do to avoid an employee stating that they will not come to work because they do not feel safe in the work environment? So those were both from the same person.
It's kind of the same thing that Aaron's talked about, being afraid or anxious of coming to work is a challenging issue. But go ahead, Aaron.
I can add one little, we talked about it, and I can add one little part to that, is you need to have a preparedness plan in place, and you should have your safety protocols in place. You may have issues with either an OSHA retaliation claim if you take an adverse employment action against an employee, or you may end up with a claim under the National Labor Relations Act if you have a union, or even if you don't have a union, if the person is refusing to work because they don't believe it's safe. The way you counter that is by saying, hey, it's safe to work. We're following all the OSHA guidelines. We've got our preparedness plan in place. If you don't have a preparedness plan in place, Mike, I think I emailed you some samples that we could provide. If not, I could do that. You could get that in place. You just need to have that a short dialogue with the employee to say, look, everything's safe here.
What Aaron is referring to is yesterday he gave us a return to work letter sample that we will be sending out either later today or tomorrow with regard to kind of covering all bases, saying it's safe, we need you to keep the business viable, you're important to us, and here's the date we're going back to work. So we'll be getting that sample return to work letter out very shortly.
Another question from the chat box. With regards to the Friday announcement of construction back to work, what date or day is that supposed to be opened up? Is that next Monday?
So it is not next Monday. It is the 7th of May is when, which is Thursday of next week, I'm sure there are some people on the call now and in our memberships of MITA and Builders Exchange who are anxious and chomping at the bit to get back to work. It sounds like, based on the announcement that happened last night, and it wasn't the official announcement, it was just a release, but it was a pretty seemed pretty official. The official one will happen on Friday when she signs the new executive order, but it will be for the following Thursday. So that Thursday morning, everybody will be able to go back to work on their projects. Obviously, there's going to require a whole lot of communication with your primes, your general contractors, your construction managers, your owners. And I know that's probably all been happening all along, but to get up and started safely is the important feature here. With COVID protocols in place, that needs to be communicated, but it also needs to be communicated then down to your own subcontractors and suppliers on how things are going to happen, because we aren't going back to work as business as usual. Things are changing dramatically, and so you're going to have to prepare for that. I think a lot of legwork can happen over the course of the next week where the things are put in play for those projects to get rolling again immediately Thursday morning. But it's going to take a lot of work to get that in place and a lot of very good communication.
This is a...
You had something to add?
Oh. Yeah, I think the preparedness part of it, I think, is a good entree into the Miss Dig system stuff. If you could just give me a couple minutes on that.
Yep.
First of all, based on that information we received late last night, I already gave the Miss Dig system a heads up. They've experienced a 20% increase weekly in the system, but it was at an all-time low. So if a regular month's at 100,000 requests, I'm just throwing out rough numbers. Last month we were at maybe 20,000 requests. We've been doing some projections based on yearly analysis of, you know, of flows of staking requests. And based on the lack of staking that's been happening and the pent-up demand, the month of May and June, May for sure, we're projecting that there could be 200,000 requests for locates. So that is astronomical. So as far as that pre-planning goes, we have put information out in our MITA bulletins on the MISDIG system. But you have 14 days from the dig start date to start work. They have 72 hours to stake it for a request. So if you do a remote ticket entry through your computer, the default is always 72 hours. But if I'm a businessman and I want to start next Thursday, I'm going to go in there and modify my dig start date and ask for that to be staked between now and next Thursday. So there's some little things that are going. We're anticipating that. The locators are bringing, the ripple effect of all of this is that they've sent locators to other states that were doing more work than Michigan. So they're calling them back to Michigan and they're trying to ramp up as we ramp up. So there's been weekly meetings with the bigs, we call them, which is, you know, your Detroit Edison's, Consumers and AT&T's of the world, along with others. We have a weekly Monday morning chat. We put some things into place that to flag tickets that are in the system that aren't getting attention. But there will be some stress here in the next month with regards to that. So the other thing that we're asking is that if you have 10 jobs and you're only starting three of them, don't ask for all 10 of them to be flagged. Try to space that work out so that the system can handle it. And the other thing to be thinking about is that the standard ticket is 21 days. So we could have this reoccurring problem every 18, 19 days. There are project tickets out there that last 180 days, but those come with a little more strength for a contractor as far as maintaining the integrity of the marks. So that's a very high level view of what's going on, but I guess the important part to take away is to think about when you're going to start that project and can you request it now and try to adjust the dig start date to, you have to start it within 14 days, but can you adjust on your projects and try to get ahead of it instead of being disappointed when the staking doesn't occur within the 72-hour time frame because the system has 10 times as many locates than it normally handles. So we will experience some pain in this area, but we're trying to mitigate it as best as possible.
Okay. I've got a question in the chat box. It's related to MDOT. So Glenn, you might have touched on it, but I'll read it just in case. We have numerous GLWA and MDOT contracts. There are numerous factors slowing us down on these projects. Some of these problems are going to have ripple effects throughout the season. An example of this is specialty equipment not being completed and delivered to us on time. Jobs that we should be completing now will be pushed back a few weeks. This pushes our entire schedule back for the entire season. How should I be handling this? MDOT has indicated they might work with us, but we have not heard from GLWA.
I think that's this question's, you know, feeds right off the prior questions that Rob and Mike were answering about how we get back to work. And let's talk about MDOT specifically first. I know we have others who don't work in the MDOT world, but we know more about what MDOT has acknowledged already. So MDOT has already acknowledged that delays that resulted from the contractor's suspension of a project or contractors who continue to work but have experienced delays due to their implementation of safety measures or impacts from sub supplier service providers downstream from them, those delays are considered excusable, and MDOT has acknowledged that already. They're excusable delays, not compensable delays, so an excusable delay, you can get time. MDOT has also said that they will not be issuing blanket extension of time requests. It's all project specific. So as a contractor on a project, prime contractor, your tools to use are your extension of time request and your updated progress schedule. And I think, as Mike said, key here is communication. So as you are able to quantify delays you're experiencing related to COVID for whatever reason, whether suspension or downstream impacts to your schedule, you need to be communicating with your engineer about extension of time request development and you're updating your progress schedule, because those are the tools that you have to use in your box. Outside the MDOT world, Great Lakes Water Authority, I'm uncertain what their provisions say in terms of their contract documents, but Eric, you can chime in too, perhaps. I would be hard-pressed to believe there's an owner that doesn't have some excusable delay language in their general conditions, and I would assume a pandemic falls under those excusable delays. As we've told our members in the past, if you're uncertain and your owner isn't giving you any clear indication of their plan, you can always use the MDOT plan as an example of, well, look what this owner's doing. This is what they're doing in terms of these COVID delays. So you could use an MDOT as an example of how they're handling delays. But Eric, maybe you can chime in on whether there would be an owner out there who wouldn't have excusable delay language from a pandemic in their contract.
You're going to get that perhaps more in the commercial construction projects, but so let me first go to GLWA. They've been very quiet, and I think it's because they can't decide what they want to do. There's too many chiefs, and so they've been asked repeatedly, and their answer has been silence. So rather than waiting for guidance, my suggestion is that you continue to try to communicate. If you ask, when are you going to start work? The question was, was kind of twofold. I have a contract that got suspended, and I have contracts that are going to start, and now my ability to reach out and start those jobs have been shifted. What are we going to do about starting the job? And on those that you have not yet started, and GLWA isn't telling you what they're going to do about whether they'll push back the starting date, at that point, first make the request, then take it under your own by saying, you haven't responded. Here's my schedule. This is what I'm capable of doing. I'm experiencing an excusable delay on my current projects, which is pushing my ability to start work out further. It's a ripple impact of the excusable delay. We all need to work together. Here's my schedule. Unless I hear from you, that is what we're going to operate under. Force the issue, and if they're quiet, then they have no reason to complain later or try to impose liquidated damages because you didn't start on time or finish on time due to their inflexible contracts.
I think that applies to all commercial projects pretty much.
I think on commercial projects, you're going to run into that where commercial owners are going to be, they're not as sophisticated in many respects, and they're going to be, I don't know what to do. Take it upon yourself to tell them what we're going to do.
Yeah.
And impose it in such a way that unless I hear from you to the contrary, this is how we're going to proceed. And I'm relying upon this for my scheduling.
And I think your point is, too, that explaining your situation is important because I don't think anyone went into this. I mean, Glenn, Rochelle, when we were talking with going back specifically to MDOT, when we were talking with MDOT leadership about this, it was never expected that this was going to be a day for a day. We shut down for 6 weeks and we open back up and we get 6 weeks on the back end. There was certainly conversations with that owner and then through to the administration that there had to be an expectation that there would be flexibility on the back end because getting started back up where things get revved back up is going to be slower than the defined shutdown that happened. It happened overnight. It happened very quickly, but the startup is going to take us a while. And so you may have supply chain issues like that was referenced in the question. You may have labor issues, tied to the COVID concerns. And so it's going to take a while to get everyone revved back up. Like Rob just said, you may have delays because of utility locating. So I think that we're going to have to use all of these things as an example as to why we need flexibility on the back end of these schedules.
Mike, you're exactly right. In fact, the guidance that came out in the actual statement out of MDOT said that as you resume work, you need to consider those supply chain and those downstream impacts that may be impacting your ability to how quickly or how soon you can complete a project. And they specifically said that's why they're not issuing across the board edict that it's a day for a day. So every job is going to be different as we would want it to be considered. So it is not necessarily day for day. So we need to acknowledge those things and in their own guidance, they've acknowledged that would be the case.
And so for private work, for local agency work, it would be good to refer to the MDOT guidance as kind of a background of how other groups could use it.
Absolutely. I mean, the key here is everyone has to be reasonable. I hate to say it, and it's being recorded, so it'll be heard forever, but you know, the state can be reasonable in this respect and use it as an example of how other owners should be operating.
Exactly. Good point.
Communication is the key. And if you're not getting what you need to hear, then use that as a guide. Here's how we're going to proceed.
And subcontractors should be doing the exact same thing with their primes. No matter what type of work you're in, we have folks from Builders Exchange on here as well. Use that type of guidance with the primes that you're working for.
Mike, in the MDOT world, that's absolutely the truth too, because the prime is the person who should be talking to the engine about any delay. So as a sub supplier service provider to a prime downstream, you need to communicate upstream with your prime contractors. They can communicate appropriately with the engineer.
Yeah.
Okay. Our next question is, what does MIDA project future MDOT budgets to look like in the months to come with the loss of revenue and taxes incurred during the shutdown period?
Lance, you want to cover this one?
Yeah, it's going to be virtually impossible to predict the future on that. There's a lot of factors that are weighing, you know, when the economy gets back up, how quickly it will, what the revenues will look like. But we've seen projections of a $7 billion state funding shortfall over the next 18 months. They're talking about, you know, they're in session today. They're talking about cutting $3 billion from this fiscal year budget, which is ending in October. So, I mean, it's a serious, we're going to have some serious budget cuts on all aspects of Michigan's budget. We put out a bulletin last week that described that the $600 million that we receive in general fund money from 2015 is severely at risk. And the majority leader has explained that in several media outlets. So we're going to be protecting that, attempting to, and we will be, you know, the gas tax and registration fee collections are down, obviously, for the months of March and will be for April as well. And we'll see how quickly those get back up. But it's tough to predict exactly what the MDOT budget will be moving forward in the future.
I think just in general, obviously a $7 billion shortfall over the next two budgets is huge. The overall state budget is what, $55 billion per year? So $3 billion cut out of it this year in unanticipated shortfalls will obviously have an impact. Lance just touched on it, and then $4 billion for next year. So a significant percentage. And then Lance just touched on it. We've all been sitting at home. I mean, we had a staff meeting yesterday, and I joked with them, I'm getting 3.5 weeks to the gallon lately with regard to the miles that we're putting on the roads. It's just been everyone's sitting at home. So we aren't bringing in the gas tax revenues. New car sales are down, so registration fee increases are probably flatlined at a minimum. I mean, we're all still paying our registration fees for the most part, but we aren't buying new vehicles at the regular clip. And so the revenues are going to be down for transportation for sure. So we'll see an impact there. The $600 million that comes in for our out of the general fund for transportation spent on state and local roads, we said from the beginning in 2015 that was a bad idea. It was constitutionally guaranteed, or constitutionally statutorily guaranteed, right, Lance? And so that just means that each year we have to fight for it. And now we come to the situation where we do have to fight for it. We're going to put up a good fight, but we also have to be understanding that this is a situation that is bigger than just the road funding. We're going to put up a good fight, told them we told them so, but it's going to be a challenge for sure. And then lastly, the governor had put forth a proposal for $3.5 billion in bonding. I guarantee the legislature is going to question that expenditure. Our argument will be that the repayment of that program comes in future years. So it won't have a huge impact on this year. It won't have any impact on this year's budget. It'll have very minimal impact on next year's budget. This was a five-year plan, and there's nothing better than a stimulus package like that to get the economy going again. So those will be our arguments. I think that one will have a little more possibilities of moving forward. In the end, the MDOT director, Paul Adjuba, has said numerous times in the media he believes that one will continue forward. But we know we're going to have a fight on our hands for all of these issues.
Mike, one follow-up to the conversation is we have heard, we just learned recently of at least one job that was in a recent letting that MDOT has rejected all bids on, and the claim was it's due to COVID budget impacts. So we're going to have conversation with MDOT about their future letting plan, because we certainly don't want them continuing to let projects and rejecting bids once everybody bids on them.
Yeah, and I will add too, in my conversations with the locals as well, is they're feeling very nervous about revenue is not coming in, and so they're a little shy about putting more projects out. And I've heard, you know, talking about canceling some projects just because they don't think the revenues are going to be there. So you may see that on the local level as well.
Well, and those projects bid throughout the summer too, so we could see some impact there for sure.
Question in the chat box that Eric has already volunteered to take. I'm about to start a municipal project that is being funded locally through a grant. We are being told that the project has to be done by a specific date. No questions asked, because if it's not done by that date, they won't receive the entire grant. Any advice?
Yeah, I mean, as Glenn said, you're entitled to a day for day plus time extension for the excusable delay. But if the owner cannot give you that extension, your construction schedule has been compressed and you're in an acceleration claim situation. You need to talk to your owner, establish what the impact is, how many extra days you're entitled to, confirm that they cannot and will not extend that date, therefore demonstrate that you've got acceleration, and set up your cost tracking system with the owner for the impact. You're going to have to be able to establish either what your productivity was beforehand with your crew costs and your crew makeup, or if you don't have that you have an established historical data that you can draw upon, and then what additional crews, additional equipment you're bringing on site, and have them track that. And if they don't agree, then you just continue to pursue your claim for acceleration damages.
Okay. This one's for Rob and Greg. Is an employer required to supply hand sanitizer on construction sites that don't have running water?
Greg, you want that or?
Well, the short answer to that is yes. That follows along with the CDC guidelines. Yes, they do.
Okay. And then one last question in Q&A. Why did MIDA suggest shutting down work early on in this situation and are now pushing to open it back up?
Very simple answer. I mean, it's elaborate, but there was very simple thinking early on. There was mass confusion 6 weeks ago when all of this took place. And first of all, everyone and their brother thought their projects were essential, from home builders who had to have their projects done by a certain date in order to get it on the market and sell it, to commercial developers who had to have their apartments leased by Labor Day for kids coming back to school. Everything was essential to everyone's pocketbooks, and that is not the definition of essential critical infrastructure as defined by Homeland Security's protocols. So we sat back and we looked at that and said, okay, that's challenging for us. We need clarification on that. But probably more importantly was the huge question marks and concerns and anxiety and fear that was out there by the employees that they were going to potentially take home the COVID to their family members. And the fact that we were concerned as an industry that we were going to be participating in overwhelming the medical systems that the front lines that were already seeming to be overwhelmed by the initial onset of this pandemic. And so the industry's position, MIDA's board of directors, took the position that in order to help alleviate the pressure on the front lines at the beginning of this pandemic, until the proper setup could be put in place at our medical centers across the state, at the hospitals, et cetera, until there was adequate personal protective equipment, we didn't need to be using it up out in the industry. We could be sharing that, donating it to the front line, to the medical facilities, if we shut down construction. and to protect the health and safety of all of the employees who are working across the industry, we took this position, and to alleviate the confusion that was out there. The governor didn't agree. Ultimately, the governor said no, but we will help to define essential critical infrastructure. And for the most part, vertical construction of all types, commercial, residential, was shut down, not just because of what we had asked for, just because critical essential infrastructure was more clearly defined by the administration. And people understood what was needed to put in place. I think our position has shifted now. I mean, we're 6 weeks into this. We've flattened the curve. We're reducing cases. We're seeing a huge number of people coming out of COVID and beating it. I think the number, Lance, that we just heard yesterday was 8,900 just in the last week or so have gotten cured of this. So we're seeing positive numbers. The supply line for PPE has started to catch up. The protocols for safe job sites has clearly been put into place. I mean, our team at MITA, Greg, Rob, all of us have been working on it along with the rest of the industry. The vertical construction industry has been working on it significantly. So the protocols are in place, how to handle job sites, how to deal with this situation out there. But the bottom line is that at some point we needed to restart this economy, and construction being one of the largest sectors of the American economy is a logical one to start for a number of reasons. Much of our industry works in the outdoors. We naturally socially space. We don't work right next to each other in cubicles. We're often socially spaced on construction projects. And we're used to dealing with safety and personal protective protocols on job sites. So with those reasons in mind, and a lot of folks ready to get back to work, we decided to work with a large contingent of contractor associations across the state to encourage the governor to say, we're ready to go back to work safely. We're ready to get rolling again, get this economy rolling, and we will bring people back safely and protect their health and well-being. And so that kind of lays it out for you from where we started to where we're at today.
That was the last question. It appears we've addressed everything in the chat box and the Q&A box and everything that was sent to us in advance, with the exception of Doug Cotton Jim's utility question, which I know, Rob, you're working on. So,
you know, I'd say out loud for Doug on that question, and Rob, you know, I would ask the government agency if there is flexibility, that if those tests were done once, they are allowed for to continue, but we can certainly look into it. I mean, there has been flexibility on other testing, that testing applies going forward. So we'll have to look into that maybe as an angle. But a lot of these tests, just like license plates, driver's license, commercial driver's license, et cetera, have been extended because the government is recognizing that there has to be flexibility in these tests that were already done and paid for, as Doug mentions. And so let's look into possibly giving some flexibility on these tests that he referenced as well.
So last chance, if anybody has a question, wants to raise their hand, submit it in the chat box. Oh, wait, Q&A again, hold on. It's Doug Cotton Jim telling Rob and Mike to call him. Okay.
Yep.
All right.
Well, thank you, everyone. We really appreciate you coming on. We had a really nice number of over 100 attendees today. And if you have any further questions, obviously feel free to pick up the phone and call us if we missed anything for you. But truly appreciate your participation, and know that we're there working on these issues daily. As Aaron said, we'll be putting out that last bulletin in very short order. we do have some more questions that have come up, Miriam.
Yes, I see that. We have a municipality that we have a contract with that has sent us construction project guidance for COVID-19 field operations. They list under job site and office practices to check each person's temperature with a touchless thermometer when they arrive to the job site, and that all subcontractors, vendors, visitors, inspectors, etc., follow all the same rules. Have to supply to them a document outlining everything we will be doing and following their guidelines, and be able to update at any given time at their request if something changes. Can we just provide the thermometers for them so we are not infringing on HIPAA? Can we have them fill out a Q&A form each day just asking them standard questions? That was a lot.
Aaron, yeah. Aaron, do you want to touch on this, or Rob?
At the question, without seeing the field guideline, the guidelines, it's a little hard to answer the question. They're specifically saying you need to use a touchless thermometer. They are available, and it's not a HIPAA violation. You're not making a record. You're just kind of zapping the person and saying, okay, you're good to go. You are, and then if you aren't, they aren't, then they go home. I agree with what was said before. I prefer the self-monitoring, but if there's no flexibility in that guidance, it's not a violation to follow it. One other part in the question was that you had to have a document laying out your,
it's an answered.
Oh, I found it. I found
yeah.
it. It said, scroll down. You have to supply them, I'm assuming that's the municipality, with a document outlining everything that we will be doing and how you're going to follow their guidelines. I'm assuming that's your preparedness plan. And everybody who goes and is operating needs to have one of those. And we can provide MITA with some samples that we'd use.
Yeah, we have
construction
that.
Industry, you're going to be at lower risk, if not at worst, medium risk, depending on how much you deal with the public.
We are, we have that already out to the members. Rob has shown it up and shared it throughout this process.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's what the guidelines are asking for. But without, yeah. I can't tell without seeing them, but yeah.
Okay, so last call. Any other questions for us in any of the three formats in which you can ask them? Okay, I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you all. Appreciate it. Call with any other questions. Take care.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Stay safe.
Bye.